Our last case, case 10-720, Bureau of Workers' Comp versus Jeffrey McKinley. We have, in place of Justice Stratton, Judge Carla Moore from the 9th District. Welcome, Judge Moore. Thank you for accommodating.
It's my pleasure.
We will start with the appellant, Mr. Bruton.
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the Court, my name is Greg Brunton. I represent the appellant, Heritage WTI. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal time. It's probably somewhat of a rare situation for the Court today when you have both insurance companies and large corporations as well as an injured worker and the plaintiff's bar seeking essentially the same result in this case.
Everybody wants justice.
And we would propose that we're on the right side of justice here, and that justice is simply this, that when the Bureau of Workers' Compensation seeks to assert subrogation rights against a company or an injured worker or a tortfeasor, they have to play by the same rules as everyone else. And that's what's at issue in this case. And you can see from the facts of this case how terribly unfair a different result could be to certainly a company or an insurance company that's paid funds or also at times an employee who has been injured. The Bureau's first argument that there is no statute of limitations at all applicable to their subrogation claims, I don't think it can be overstated how that could wreak havoc on the judicial system and, candidly, companies and insurance carriers that would have to carry these liabilities on the books theoretically forever. It would be a terrible injustice for injured workers or for companies for the Bureau of Workers' Compensation to be able to bring a subrogation case 10 years, 20 years, 100 years after the injury when witnesses are gone, dead, documents are destroyed, the company has no ability to defend itself, the employee has no ability to defend himself or herself. I think that almost goes without saying, and I don't want to beat that dead horse. And we think that their argument is both legally incorrect and that Sullivan doesn't apply. Time does run against the king when you're bringing a subrogation claim. This
Counsel,
is a subrogation claim.
Yes. The 7th District did not comment upon that argument. Am I correct?
It's correct because it was not raised in the court below. And I saw in the BWC brief where they claim that argument was made. But if the court looks at their brief in the 7th Circuit, or 7th District, that argument was not raised before the trial court. The Sullivan case was not raised at the Court of Appeals, and it is raised for the first time here on appeal. So the 7th District did not get a chance to comment on that case. So we're now left with the issue of which statute of limitations applies. Is it going to be a 2-year statute, or is it going to be a 6-year statute? And we strongly contend that it should be a 2-year statute of limitations. This court has several pronouncements, and courts of appeals have numerous pronouncements that say the simple and understandable proposition of law that if you're bringing a subrogation claim, your rights are no greater than the party you're subrogated to. You take to the rights of the party you're subrogated to. And to carve out an exception to that right, to the statute of limitations, makes little sense. It's inconsistent with the law. It's inconsistent with the plain language of the statute. Bureau would like to argue, and the 7th District or 7th District held below, that somehow this is not a subrogation claim. And I find this argument, I've always found it surprising. I was surprised that it was accepted by the Court of Appeals. The statute at issue literally calls the BWC, the Bureau, or a company that's seeking to assert the subrogation rights, they literally call them the statutory subrogate. That's what the language of the statute calls them, a statutory subrogee. The language of the statute explicitly says they are subrogated to the rights of the claimant, but the plain language of the statute clearly establishes that this is a good old-fashioned subrogation cause of action. It is not an independent right of recovery, as the 7th District found. Everything about their claim depends upon the claim of the injured worker. The legal theory has to be there for the injured worker. The lost wages have to be there for the injured worker. The medical damages have to be there for the injured worker before the BWC has any claim to bring for subrogation.
Counsel, if I could, let me ask how you deal with the language in 412393 that says that payment of compensation creates a right of recovery.
It does create a right of recovery, but the recovery is a subrogation right of recovery. There's no, and I guess we wouldn't be here except for the fact that sometimes these statutes are not, are sometimes somewhat awkwardly worded. But what's interesting about the phrase right of recovery, I would contend it's actually a limiting phrase. It's actually a limiting phrase on the BWC's rights. In this sense, what the statute does is it sets out somewhat a rather complicated formula, but it sets out a statutory formula by which the BWC's rights to recover subrogation are limited depending upon the uncompensated loss, et cetera. So is it a right of recovery? In a sense, it is a right of recovery, but that right of recovery does not turn into an independent right of recovery. We just need to read the rest of the statute that says the right of recovery is a recovery that is a subrogation right, and they're subrogated to the rights of the claimant.
Mr. Bruton, when does the cause of action accrue?
We believe it accrues, candidly, at the date of injury. And the reason why we
believe... I'm sorry?
The date of injury. The same time the tortfeasor's cause of action would accrue.
Not the date of settlement.
Not the date of settlement, in our view. In our view. Now, candidly, if you found in this case that the cause of action accrued on the date of settlement, the result would be the same. Our client would be entitled to relief, and it would still be beyond the statute of limitations because the settlement occurred in 2004, and this case was not filed in 2008, assuming you found a two-year statute. But the reason why we say it should be the same right as the tortfeasor is there's a few reasons for this, one of which is for the Bureau to claim that they have no notice of these injuries and how they occur is just simply not true. When Mr. McKinley or any other claimant gets injured, they have to go to the Bureau, they have to submit an application, they have to tell the Bureau their injury and how it happened. The Bureau is put on notice immediately of an injury. They're put on notice of when the injury occurs and how it occurs. And they have their own mechanism to investigate these claims and figure out whether or not there's a potential cause of action. The second most critical thing, and it's worth pointing out because the BWC, I don't think, wants to acknowledge this, is that even if you make the statute of limitations begin to accrue at the time of the injury, the BWC's argument is, well, you know, we might not know about it. The case might proceed through the system for a year or two, and then all of a sudden we're faced with a potential settlement, and now we're finding out about it at the last minute. But under the civil rules, Civil Rule 24, they have obviously a right to intervene in the action at any time, and their intervention relates back to the filing of the original complaint by the tortfeasor, and we've cited case law in our brief on this issue.
But they don't have to intervene, is that correct?
Correct.
And the in this particular case, my understanding from reading the briefs is that the Bureau of Workers' Comp was advised at every step of the proceedings here?
Well, they were certainly advised by October of 2004. The case was filed. The injury occurs in 2003. The case is filed. They're notified of the settlement and the settlement discussions in October of 2004. And then the Attorney General is also notified in November of 2004.
And that's when the case was dismissed pursuant to a settlement agreement?
Shortly afterwards. And this is part of the awkwardness in the record in this case. And I know the settlement agreement's not part of the record, but the settlement agreement was reached in December of 2004. And the parties were facing, as counsel in the trial court on this, that the underlying trial court case, Mr. McKinley's case against Heritage and Safeway, that this is a perfect example of how the BWC's position can really chill settlements. Because we were faced with a situation, we've got a case coming up for trial, it's a month or two before trial, we've got a motion for summary judgment pending, we think it's meritorious, but on the other hand, we know we have an extremely injured sympathetic plaintiff. And so we're faced with, well, what do we do? They can't reach a settlement with the BWC. Do we just have to go to trial now because the BWC won't agree to what their subrogation claim is? Are we forced to actually go to a jury and not settle our case? That was the choice we were facing. And so what did we do? We settled the case The settlement agreement provides that Mr. McKinley must pay the BWC lien. And we paid Mr. McKinley a lot of money, way more than the BWC lien. And the settlement agreement says, you take care of the lien. That's your problem. And the BWC and you can fight that out. But the only alternative provision we had was literally to go to trial and take the statutory trial procedure just because Mr. McKinley and the BWC were at loggerheads. And we argued this is obviously
that wasn't the situation you found yourself in.
We were in that situation. We were in the situation where we would have either had to essentially go to trial because the BWC could not agree with Mr. McKinley about what
I guess I didn't understand that, but maybe I missed it, was that there wasn't an interaction between the BWC and the injured worker over this lawsuit at this time. That they were being notified of it, but that there was no intervention or active participation by the BWC.
In the underlying lawsuit, they did not intervene. They were not a party, and that's exactly our concern and our point, and why we think the statute should not be extended. Because what it allowed the BWC to essentially do in this case is sit there, put us in a position where we had to essentially settle the case. We had to give the money to Mr. McKinley, or our only other option was to try it.
Well, now, what about the option of writing your check to both of them and let them fight it out, and then you would be out of it?
Well, that was the problem is we were not convinced, and we did not think that Mr. McKinley and his attorney would take that option. They were prepared to go to trial, and putting the check and saying, okay, here's the check, but you don't get to cash it.
So
we could not guarantee a settlement on those terms.
So you wrote into the settlement agreement, that he was responsible for to compensate the Bureau of Workers' Comp, correct?
Correct.
And holding that dollar amount, which was it was known at the time, in escrow or placing it with the court for a determination, that wasn't discussed?
It was not discussed. At the time, we felt like all the parties felt that the BWC and Mr. McKinley were going to settle the claim. They'd been put on the notice, and they were talking to each other. It appeared at the time there was going to be a settlement between those two parties.
So the statute requires that you give the Bureau and the Attorney General notice, which was done.
Technically, Mr. McKinley has to do that, and he did.
Okay. So then the Bureau then doesn't do anything until, was it 2006? When did they seek to?
2008.
2008.
They're
notified in 2004.
Correct.
That there has been a settlement.
Correct.
And they don't do anything until 2008.
At least with regard to our client. Now, they're going to tell you we were in litigation with Mr. McKinley because Mr. McKinley had filed a declaratory judgment action as to how much money he had to pay the BWC or whether or not the statute was constitutional. So they had ongoing litigation with Mr. McKinley. But our client, there was no action taken against our client until 4 years after we settled the case and 5 years after the injury. I guess I would point out to the court that from our perspective, that is so clearly beyond the statute of limitations. And it is, frankly, one of the arguments the Bureau has made. I see I have my time is up.
You're into your rebuttal, but let me ask you, do you have another alternative for the employer to go against Mr. McKinley?
We can.
For breach of the contract that you, settlement contract?
We can. We can absolutely do that. We're hoping not to have to.
I understand. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kearney?
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. We have no statute of limitations, or we have a 6-year. But before getting to that, I want to correct some factual points in several respects. First, page 11 of our brief in the 7th District, Sullivan cited no statute of limitations. So the statement that we never raised it below, I simply am perplexed by. We did. Moreover, this court said in Lawyers Cooperative Publishing versus Muthing that when the issue before the court is statute of limitations, the question is yes or no. Did you file in time? And any sub-issues about whether the reason you made it in time is whether it's 2 or 4 or 6 or none at all are all just sub-issues. So that issue is plainly before the court. But also, on a factual matter, this came to the court on a 12B6. And so there isn't a fully developed record other than the complaint. So I feel constrained to not go outside that record. But I note, since counsel talked all about the settlement, which is not in the record, that we do have an administrative record that if we get past 12b-6, we can show that we did not sit back for 5 years and do nothing. We had a settlement conference counsel was at with all three parties at the table trying to settle. We didn't reach settlement, and then those two settled without us. So they were there at the table. They stopped coming to the table.
In the underlying case.
Now, in the workers' comp claim, as soon as he filed a claim within the two-year period, so even if it were a two-year, we had an administrative conference with the Bureau, Mr. McKinley, and Counsel for Heritage.
And did the Bureau assert a claim at that point for compensation?
We did. Not only that, but when Mr. McKinley then sued us because we couldn't settle, Mr. McKinley sued us in 2004 and spent 4 years in litigation with us. So it's not that we did nothing. We had a claim against us filed.
Were you waiting for that suit to be decided before you went after the Heritage?
Yes, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, his claim, which even came to this court, so it's on this court's docket. It was held for Groach. His claim said two things. One, it's unconstitutional, the whole statute. And two, he said, I want a declaration of how much I owe. So the amount of the claim was already in litigation. Now, in retrospect, we acknowledge maybe we should have pleaded them as a third party, but we were back and forth with Mr. McKinley. They were on notice of the claim the entire time. And in addition, the statute says, if you look at 0.931H, it says that the statutory subrogee, which could be the Bureau or a self-insured employer, may assert its rights by correspondence with the party or representative. So we had letters, even the letters they attached.
How did your case or dispute with Mr. McKinley turn out?
Well, here's what happened, and this is covered in the brief, and it's restated both in the Seventh District's opinion below and in the Fourth District's opinion from his claim against us. He brought us all the way up to this court, held for a year and a half for Groach, and as soon as this court decided Groach, a month or two later, he 41A, voluntarily dismissed. So then we turn around and filed our own lawsuit against both parties. So we didn't do nothing. We were a defendant against, or we were a defendant in a suit McKinley filed against us, a suit they knew about, they had been at the table. And again, this is all not in the record because it's a 12b-6, other than the parts that are in the Fourth District public opinion and the briefs filed in this court in that other case.
Is the right of the Bureau statutory?
It is. And this court said in McAuliffe that there's a simple but-for test. Would we have the right to sue without the statute? The test isn't, did the legislature establish a statute that used concepts that had been around for centuries in common law? It's, would we have the right to sue? And if he asked flat out, could we sue without that statute? No. That's
okay,
why when
so
our
you have a statutory right, and that right is a right of subrogation.
Well, no, Your Honor. They do use that term because that's...
When you say they, who do you mean?
Well, the legislature used the term subrogation because, in part, we borrow from traditional subrogation.
Well,
but
aren't
the liability,
subrogated rights derivative rights?
Not here, Your Honor. It's independent for two reasons, at least two, but several. First, keep in mind, this very case and all similar cases are not just filed against Heritage, the tortfeasor. We filed the suit against McKinley and Heritage. So how can we be standing in McKinley's shoes when we're suing McKinley? He couldn't sue himself. That right there shows this is distinct. This isn't a pass-along of we sue them because he could have sued them. We're suing Mr. McKinley. And keep in mind that in this very case, the trial court gave McKinley, the same person who kept us running around in circles for 4 years before 41A-ing the case, they gave him the benefit of the statute of limitations and let him out of the collection actions. And he didn't even, show up here. So if this court were somehow to reverse for Heritage, the court needs to specify that Mr. McKinley should still be on the hook, and we can go after
There's
him.
No statute of limitations contained in the authorization for the Bureau to file.
Correct.
To file
and
this.
That's what triggers Sullivan, because their arguments about Sullivan, as I said, are not waived. We did raise it below. They did not object to that, so they waived the waiver. But also, in
How
the
do
Sullivan
you determine
case,
if there's no statute... if there's no statute of limitations specified in the statute that authorizes the Bureau to file a claim, how do you determine it's, as you said, I think, 6 years or none?
Well, there are two answers, Your Honor. The none comes from
Just
Sullivan.
Just give me one of them. How do you determine 6 years?
Okay. Well, first, I'll take them in either order. 6 years is because this the statute 230507 says any liability created by a statute is 6 years from when the action accrues. And the
what's the outcome in this case?
Fine, because we were not only within 6 years of the injury, but the action doesn't accrue until there's a settlement. And I also want to point out that here's a fundamental problem with their argument that it's 2 years from the injury. Someone could run out the clock. Yes, most claimants do file in a month if they want to start getting money, but the claim in workers' comp can be filed up to 2 years from the injury. So someone could literally do this under their primary argument if they don't concede moving it back.
Well, we don't have to get to the parade of horribles that you want to display, but here's the question I have. You say it's a 6-year statute, right?
Well, none or six.
I understand, but if we stay with a 6-year position, when does it commence in your view?
It commences when all the elements exist, that we've paid a claimant and that they've collected tort money, whether by settlement or judgment.
So it really doesn't have a definitive start date. It's all dependent.
No, it does have a definitive start, but it's whenever the third piece of the puzzle comes together that there's a claimant who's been paid workers' comp money, has also collected tort money, and that we know about it. It's as soon as those come together, whichever comes last.
And all of that is in which statute?
It's under 4123-931G that says if they settle and exclude the amount owed to us, that creates a joint and several liability. So it creates it right then and there. But the other thing, I do want to get back to the parade of horribles because it will and can happen.
Before you do that, tell me why you say there's no statute of limitations.
Because this court said in Sullivan versus ODOT flat out, if the state is not specifically made subject to a general statute of limitations that applies to others, then there's none. And it's not because time doesn't run against the king. It's because, as this court said, every jurisdiction, other states and the federal government cover, the idea is that the taxpaying public, or in this case, premium-paying insurers, shouldn't lose their rights simply because some government bureaucrat, me, I hope not, waits too long to file. And this court said it's to the legislature to put in a statute of limitations. This court has never overruled Sullivan. They don't make a Gelatus showing for why it's proved unworkable because the legislature can respond. But here's why the 2-year is impractical. Someone has 2 years to file a workers' comp claim and 2 years to file a tort. Someone could literally wait until the last day, never tell us, never file a workers' comp claim, settle in the morning, come at 4:59 p.m.,
but then you'd be under the 6 years. Because if that happened, you'd be under 6 years.
Right, but I'm saying here's why the 2-year can't be right. Because if there are two parallel 2-year clocks running.
Well, the 2-year could be right because under your hypothetical, you say you don't get notice and they settle on the last day. If you don't get notice, you clearly then fall back to the 6 year.
That's true, Your Honor, under our reading. What I'm saying is they say it's 2 years from the injury. And if it's 2 years from the injury, someone could file on the last day at 4:59, and by the time we open the envelope, we've already lost our claim. Certainly the legislature didn't write a statute to allow for
that. Can I ask you something? I'm sorry. Why did you not intervene in the underlying action?
Because, well, there are a number of reasons, Your Honor, some of which may not be, nothing's in the record, but when somebody goes out and files a tort suit, it could be a frivolous suit. It could be a real one. The Bureau doesn't want to come out. If you're
talking about, but you said you were in discussions with Mr. McKinley for the last 4 years.
But that means that they have an obligation before they settle to let us know. And if they do exclude us from the settlement, that triggers our rights. So they settle at their peril. They knew when they settled that there's a joint and several liability that comes down on them. And so we'd like to, and in most cases we can, get all three parties at the table and settle. But it's not the notice alone that triggers our rights here, because otherwise someone could notify and then simply negotiate to impasse and say, ha-ha, we settled without you. Sorry, you're out of luck. The only thing that triggers the right is the settlement's exclusion of us. The notice helps us try to prevent getting to that point, and the notice helps us to try to have a three-way negotiation. But if all else fails and no one will agree with us, if they settle, that triggers right away our accrual of a right to go after them and say, hey, you two sued among yourselves, but we have a right to get in here. And that right can't be abolished by their unilateral or bilateral contract.
Mr. Carney, on Sullivan and the statute 230507, did Sullivan, the case that was talking about no statute when the state is involved, did that case refer to the section, the statutory section that talks about 6 years for a statute?
It wasn't
that
the
6 year
under 07. It was either, I think, point 10 or one of the others.
But the one that was at issue.
It wasn't a 6 year there. I think it was a a 4 or a 10. I'm not sure. It wasn't this specific one, but it was part of the 2305 where there's 06, 07, 08. It was a different one at issue, but the court said as a general rule, whenever you have one of these generally worded ones, if you don't specifically put the state in, the state is not subject to it. So this court would have to reverse Sullivan to go his way.
Even though there's a statute that says if there's no statute of limitations, we're right. going to impose a 6-year?
But that statute doesn't mention the state, and that statute would apply here, for example, a self-insured employer who could be a statutory subrogee. If a self-insured pays out someone and then gets left out of a settlement, in our view, although it's not before the court,
so
they would face a 6-year.
So you're saying they could potentially have 6 years to sue, and in your view, the state could sue 25 years
right.
later.
But keep in mind, we're not going to do that. Realistically, the only reason this got delayed for 4 or 5 years is because we were in active litigation with Mr. McKinley on a claim that specifically was about how much he owed. In most cases, the reason
well,
we
counsel,
have
Well, counsel, you keep talking about your active participation. Doesn't that all come down to an equitable argument as to why you shouldn't be left at the church in this case? Rather than a you're really left with no
right.
position or, where you actually undertook what was available to you to protect yourself.
Well, Your Honor, first the statute sets out, the statute decided here's what we think is equitable. Here's your notice, here's your chance, and if they exclude you, here's your right to sue. So the statute has already incorporated those equitable notions, so this court doesn't have to worry about any more free-floating equity. But if you do look at equity, it's certainly not equitable to have a rule, certainly not the 2-year rule where someone could file on the last day and we lose our statute of limitations before we're put on notice. But even if you back it up to the notice point...
Well, what I'm struggling with is the concept of equity intertwined with the concept of a statute of limitations seem to me to be as about foreign to each other as they come. Statutes of limitations are harsh rules.
No, they're not, Your Honor, because they're a way to incorporate the idea that after so many years, you know, if witnesses are gone, et cetera. But I want to return to the point that we're not going to take forever, because if we don't collect right away, an injured worker might not have $800,000 if 7 or 8 years later. A company could go bankrupt and not have it. We have every incentive to go in the first year. And here, the only glitch was that Mr. McKinley, who again was given by the trial court the benefit of this ruling, he sued us for a few years. So we had an ongoing case. It was just flip-flopped on plaintiff and defendant, but we had an ongoing case, and then all of a sudden he pulled the plug, and then we went ahead and filed. So the idea that we did nothing is simply not true factually.
What is the status of the settlement money? Is it still available, or is it dissipated?
Well, we're not sure. Because we got kicked out at 12b-6, we did no discovery. We filed a complaint against both of them. The trial court threw it out. The appeals court put it back on track. So we don't know how much money he has, but we believe the statute says they're jointly and severally liable. The statute uses the phrase joint and several. So a settlement can't just say, we're going to walk away, you deal with the Bureau. Two parties can't trump a statute. If the statute says it's joint and several, that means joint and several. But we don't reach that point until we get to even litigating this case. And again, the statute of limitations here did not run because Sullivan says none. 6 is just as good to us. We feel compelled to say Sullivan because that's this court's precedent. But 6 is perfectly workable as long as it's 6 from the back end. And again, there's so many features of the statute, like suing Mr. McKinley himself, that
and,
show.
And just so I'm clear, the 6 would start to run when there's a payout, when there's a settlement for a tort. I mean, a payout to the
right.
injured.
Both forms of payout. Right.
And notice of that specific settlement is given to the Attorney General of the Bureau of Workers' Comp.
Right. Otherwise, you could just say hide the ball for 6 years and run it out. And
right.
there's never been a statute of limitations where knowledge is not part of it, whether it's med mal knowledge or anything. And again,
right.
even
Thank
if
you, Mr. Kearney.
Thanks.
Mr. Brunton, you have a minute and a half left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I stand corrected on one issue. Sullivan was cited in their brief on page 11. Other than that, I'm going to disagree with everything else Mr. Kearney said to you. A few brief issues. First of all, Sullivan did not apply to a subrogation case. The Sullivan case, on its face, stands for the proposition that when there's a direct claim by the state,
then there's no statute. Time doesn't run against the king. It does not on its face apply to a subrogation claim. Whether the court imposes a discovery rule, so to speak, that the statute of limitations runs either at the time of the injury, like it would for the tortfeasor, or when they discover a settlement has occurred, if the court uses a two-year statute, like we would urge, the result in this case would be the same. And so we don't have a big dispute here about whether or not you say the statute of limitations runs when the injury occurs or when they discover a settlement is about to happen. We would urge, though, that that statute of limitations is the same. It's the same because it's got to be based upon the rights of the party they're subrogated to, which is 2 years in this case.
Mr. Kearney would have us believe that there was a longstanding litigation between yourself, your client, and the Bureau, and the case was dismissed.
That's not with us. He's speaking of the case with Mr. McKinley.
I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
And we were never brought into that case. And candidly, I don't want to take too many pot shots.
You were not a party to that lawsuit.
We were not. And I don't want to take too many pot shots at the lawyering by the Bureau in this case, but they did not bring us into that case in 2005, which they could have, and they did not counterclaim against Mr. McKinley for their monies, which I would argue not only they should have done, it was probably compulsory counterclaim. And so this whole idea that Mr. McKinley, you know, pulled one over on him and delayed their case for 4 years, they had obvious remedies under the civil rules. They could have third-partied us in 2005 in that case, or they could have brought their compulsory counterclaim in 2005 against Mr. McKinley, and that case would still be pending. Mr. McKinley couldn't have essentially pulled a fast one on them and said, ha-ha, I'm dismissing the case. And honestly, there were remedies under the civil rules there. And essentially what they're asking you to do is to create an extended different statute of limitations, not justified, to justify, candidly, their own mistakes in how they handled the case against Mr. McKinley.
Thank you. We will take this matter under advisement, and an opinion will be released.